Dr. Jacques Gauthier, and he's from Toronto, Canada, eh? And something like that. And he is probably, I don't know, the world's leading expert on the international law as it relates to who owns the land of Israel and Jerusalem. He spent 20 years working. He is an international lawyer by profession, and he spent 20 years at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. It wasn't Geneva, Pennsylvania, but or someplace like that. Geneva, Switzerland, and international studies and international law, he wrote his dissertation, which, are you going to show it? Yeah, okay. I mean, goodness, thing is that thick. It's bigger than a Sears catalog back in the day. And he is going to explain to us, or as Ricky used to say to Lucy, he's going to explain to us why it is that Israel has the legal rights, in spite of what you hear on television from the propaganda machine about how they're occupying illegally the land and all that kind of stuff. So, Dr. Gauthier, come on up and do your thing.
Want to make sure you hear me. Howdy. Dr. Lay, what a privilege to be here. I'm not sure the organizers have been entirely fair inviting such a fantastic musician. What an act to follow, and how gifted you are, and how much of a blessing it was. And now I have to tune in to something which I want to share with you tonight. And I did come from Toronto last night and spent several hours in our room today because I wanted to make sure that what I presented to you was in tune with this environment. This very, very special state of the United States. And so I worked hard today, and I hope the rapture won't take place before I present my talk. I want you here. I don't know if you've got any insights on that, but it wouldn't be fair. I want you here. I do have a PowerPoint presentation, and it is my hope that many of you will be able to see it. I don't know if the lights could be dimmed a little bit so that the screen could be seen, because it's a major undertaking to try to summarize this. It is 10 kilos. And if you get two of them, it's great for exercising. I did not spend 20 years at the Institute in Geneva. I worked on this for a period of more than 20 years while I was practicing international law, while I was interacting with the five women that live with me. One wife, four daughters. Please. These two people looked at each other over there, and they were very concerned. It's according to the rules. And we now have a granddaughter. It's a girl again, so we specialize. And it was interesting to hear Tommy talk about his four sisters who are here tonight, and honored to meet Tommy's mother and the four girls. He pointed out that you're sitting in the way you were born. So it's a privilege to live with so many women. And I should say that but for my wife Ronnie, and I would like her to stand up right now. And but for my daughters, I could not have completed this. You see, this is a PhD thesis, and the thesis was, if you could go to the next slide, I don't have my little device, so my friend has promised to keep an eye on me and make the move whenever necessary. The thesis had to be prepared under the supervision of a great scholar, thank you very much, whose name is Marcelo Cohen. He, being Jewish, has published a thesis which won the Guggenheim Prize. And when he first met with me, he said, Jacques, I don't share many of your views and positions, but we'll do it this way. If you are prepared to defend and support each and every paragraph in your thesis, if you're prepared to do this in a scholarly way, in a scientific way, I'll agree to be your thesis director. Otherwise, look for somebody else. And I admired the work of Professor Cohen, and I decided, no, I'm going to do it his way. Because of him, I've got 3,200 footnotes in this document. Because of him, it took 20 years. You know, I'll refer to Herzl's thesis in a few minutes. Dr. Herzl, his thesis is barely 80 pages. It's not fair. He got a doctorate. But, you know, as a result of those demands, these very, very difficult years of drafting the thesis, the end result is a very comprehensive document. And I now am able to present my findings, and I must tell you, I have concluded that the Jewish people and the state of Israel have been given legal rights, which involves issues of sovereignty in respect to Jerusalem. The majority today, whether we're talking about scholars, world leaders, Secretary General of the United Nations, I've concluded that, if I can borrow an expression used a few times tonight, that the Jews are outlaws in Jerusalem. And I'm confronted as I go here, there, and everywhere, whether it's the Japanese Parliament, the Congress in Washington, the House of Commons in London, the Senate in Rome, where I've made my presentation, the Parliament in Brussels. I'm confronted with the question, but the majority has concluded that international law supports the Palestinian position. My response to that is that the majority is wrong. And tonight what I want to do is I want to try to summarize my findings. That's not easy. But I'm going to try to do it, and I do need the help of the images, and I hope you can see them, and I'll explain things a little more, assuming that some of you are having difficulty to seeing them. You see, I must explain this. I'm aware that I'm surrounded by people of faith, people of deep faith. And having listened to you, Dr. LaHaye, I know that as a result of your faith, you believe that Israel, the Jewish people, are special to God. You believe that they have entitlements and rights in respect to Jerusalem and the Holy Land. The problem is this. If you go to where I go, if you go into parliaments, if you go to the Knesset, if you go to any place, including the Knesset, because the Jewish people, the Israelis, are very divided on the question of Jerusalem. And you support your position by reference to Scripture, whether you're Jewish or Christian. It is a language that is not recognized by the nations. Please hear me. If you say to a world leader, please honor the claims of the Jewish people because it says thus and thus in the book of Ezekiel or in Zechariah or in many other prophetic books of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament as Christians call it, they won't pay any attention to what you have to say. There's a language they will listen to. Law and politics. So what I'm here to do tonight is not in any way to discourage you in respect to prayer, to discourage you in wanting to know more about the principles that are being covered by your lectures over the next days. But I'm here in a way to say it's not enough. It's a matter of justice. It's a matter of ethics. I was asked to speak to a very interesting group in Houston, Texas. And I met you, my brother, there. And at the end of my presentation, a relatively young man came to me, and I didn't realize this, but his job was to protect me. He was a Texas Ranger. And he was on duty that night. And he came to me at the end of the evening, and somehow he had been touched by some part of my presentation. And he took out a little piece of paper and he wrote something on it. And he gave it to me, and I have it with me tonight. It's my second presentation in Texas, therefore, Houston, and now this area. And it says this, Tzedek, Tzedek, Tzerdov. Justice, justice you shall pursue. It's from Deuteronomy 16:20. Interestingly, it goes on to say, the same scripture, so you may live and possess the land the eternal God has promised you. So in a sense, I'm here tonight to encourage you to listen to the summary of my findings. And I'm hopeful that you'll be remembering the cornerstones, the essential aspects of it, so that when the opportunity comes, you will pursue justice by standing with the Jewish people and the citizens of Israel when they state that they have the right to retain a unified Jerusalem as their capital. I became involved in the study of the legal aspects of Jerusalem after being involved in so many other issues involving human rights. I've been preoccupied with matters of justice for decades. Whether it was the rights of children in Africa, or I led a delegation of human rights experts to China to negotiate with the Central Party in Beijing. I've been involved in trying to deal with human rights in Zimbabwe, in Afghanistan, in Haiti, and there are abuses, there are violations of rights in different parts of the world. But nothing has concerned me more than what the world is doing today in respect to the issue of Jerusalem. The way prejudice is evident in the actions of the nations, not only in respect to Israel, but to the Jewish people in different countries. even places like France, where I was brought up. The key thing that you have to understand is that whatever is being said today is a result of the effective work of a propaganda machine that has been embraced by the nations. Let's continue. I'm going to show you the Graduate Institute where I defended my thesis in 2006. Please remember the Villa Barton. I'm going to come back to the Villa Barton in a few moments. It's significant in different ways. It's in that villa that I actually faced the three professors who questioned me for over 3 hours, trying to undo aspects of my arguments. And in the end, they honored me with the doctorate. And despite their hesitation in embracing the conclusions, said some very, very encouraging things. Some people might say, well, 20 years? That's a long time. Well, I don't know how many of you know the Sagrada Familia Cathedral in Barcelona, the great masterpiece of Antonio Gaudi. He started it in 1883. It's not done yet. They think it's going to be completed around 2026. And he was interviewed and asked to explain the slow pace of his project. And then he turned around and said, my client is not in a hurry. As far as Israel is concerned, as far as Jerusalem is concerned, even though it appears right now that most nations are prepared to deny the rights of Israel, this story is far from over. And what I have to say now, and I'll say in conclusion in a few minutes as well, it doesn't matter that I'm in a minority, provided that I'm convinced that my conclusions are the right ones. We're dealing with truth. When you deal with truth, it's always right to speak and always wrong to be silent. When you're dealing with truth, it is always wrong to do nothing. So my hope tonight, as it has been in many, many different settings of the world, is that many of you, after listening to this presentation, will do something. I'm not going to tell you what to do. But it's not right at the time when so many are wrongly accusing Israelis of trespassing in Jerusalem, of being odious usurpers in Jerusalem, of being wrongful settlers and occupants in Jerusalem. It's not right to accept that. Reminds me of driving once many years ago with my family. The kids were young and we were going to Florida. I hadn't discovered Texas yet. along the way we'd stop occasionally. We wouldn't do it in one night. And there kept being this big sign. I don't know. I think it's in Tennessee. And they kept advertising this underwater sea. And after a while, we got intrigued. It was time to take a break, and we stopped and toured this underwater sea. For us Canadians, it was more like a little pond. But the noteworthy moment is when the guide took us way down, and he said, well, we're going to do something. It was a big cave with water, and he turned off the lights. I had never experienced total darkness in my life before. It was dark. Complete darkness. And then he did something else. He took a match and he lit it. And it was a big place, bigger than, much bigger than this room. And this tiny, tiny little match lit up the whole room. Unbelievable. And I think about that experience when I speak around the world. No matter how predisposed those in the audience might be, I remember, only takes a little bit of light to dispel darkness. And all of you can do that. Next slide, please. So, let's start talking about Jerusalem. You see here an outline of the municipality of Jerusalem, and I don't know if you can see it, but the yellow area in the middle of Jerusalem is the old city of Jerusalem. Next slide. That's the green line. I'm sure many of you have heard about the green line. In fact, what the nations are proclaiming today is that Israel should let go of all territories within the green line, including all of the Jerusalem that's within the green line. The green line has become sacred. There's a mantra repeated over and over, over again. The green line. Get out, Jews. The green line. What is the green line? Next slide. The green line is in fact the armistice line that you will find described in the armistice agreement made between Israel and Jordan in April of 1949. This is, you know, sometimes tonight I'm going to tell you, pay particular attention. This is a good moment. Maybe I should get my guitarist behind me. And every time I get to one of these moments, you just, vroom. It's one of them moments. Article 2 specifies what the green line is. It's the line where the people who have been killing each other are supposed to stop fighting. And you'll see, if you can't see it, what it says in red here is, no provision of this agreement shall in any way prejudice the rights, claims, and positions of the parties. This is so important from a legal point of view. If we're fighting each other and we stop, this is covered by the law of war. Can we see the next slide? And the next slide. Okay, well, it's a little further down. Back up to where we were. What the law of war says is that there are certain things, some minimum standards that have to be complied with when people are killing each other. And one of those things is that if you stop fighting and you honor the provisions of the agreement, you don't have to worry about any implications in respect to sovereignty claims, political claims. So the green line was where they stopped fighting. And it says right in the agreement, it's not supposed to be the source of rights. You can't later on stand up and say, I want that territory because the line was there. You can't do that under the law of war. It's another chapter of international law that deals with questions of acquisition of territory and sovereignty. Somewhere else, not there. So look at what happens if you use the green line to divide Jerusalem. The dark green is the area of the future Palestinian state that would be their capital. The remnant of the dark blue is all that's left of the capital for the Jewish state. And all of the light green around is the Palestinian state that is being proposed if you use the green line. Next slide. When you go around the world and you deal with the politicians and the scholars that I encounter, they say, but they've got to get out of Arab East Jerusalem. How many times have you read that? Arab East Jerusalem. In fact, in the area that they're referring to are large Jewish communities. Every blue area that you see there is a Jewish neighborhood. Hundreds of thousands of Jews live in the so-called Arab East Jerusalem, and the entirety of the old city is on that side of the green line. My thesis focuses on the old city. Why? Let's keep going. The position of Israel as far as Jerusalem is concerned, it's still right now, despite negotiations in the past where different positions were presented, Jerusalem is going to continue to be the capital. The entire Jerusalem will continue to be the capital of the Jewish state. Next slide. The position of the Palestinians, and that is a false statement, and I'll tell you why, is that all of Arab East Jerusalem should be the capital of Jerusalem. I say it's false because who won the election in the Palestinian areas several years ago? I believe it was 2006. That was Hamas. And notwithstanding the fact that more people voted for Hamas than they voted for Abbas, the others retained control and power over at least part of the Palestinian areas. And it's not possible for you to say today, or for anyone to say, that Hamas agrees with this. Let's continue. The position of Hamas is that the entirety of Jerusalem should be under Palestinian control. Next slide. In fact, Hamas says the entirety of the Holy Land should be under their control. And that's also the position of Hezbollah. It's also the position of the Iranians. Many in the neighborhood feel that way, including the Syrian leadership. Next. Why my focus on the old city? I won't spend much time explaining to you the subdivisions of the old city. There are four quarters, including a Jewish quarter and an Arab quarter. Nothing is more important in the old city than the Temple Mount, which you see the big rectangle there, and I'll come back to that. Next slide. You have to understand that if you take a picture of Jerusalem in the first century before it was destroyed, it was essentially what the old city is today. A little more on one side, but it very much resembles what the old city is today. Next slide. If you move the clock forward and look at the Jerusalem after it was rebuilt by the Romans in 135 AD, it's very, very, very much similar to the old city today. Next. This is Crusader Jerusalem in the 12th century. Look at the configuration. Next. This is a lithograph. I'm a collector of lithographs, and I have tons of those in my thesis. This is a lithograph of Jerusalem in the mid-19th century, before the Jews started to move, as Dr. Lehi mentioned, to the Holy Land in the mid-19th century. This depicts Jerusalem as the old city. There's nothing outside the walls, according to this lithograph. The next one is a map I found in a French book, mid-19th century, and this is a detailed map, and you can find almost no structures, almost nothing outside the walls. Next. Oh, did we skip one? Okay. We'll say this. Jerusalem, according to those who really want it, is the old city. If you look at 20 centuries, starting with the first century until the middle of the 19th century, there was nothing really outside the walls. The Jerusalem that counts for both the Jewish people and those who are claiming rights in respect to that city is the old city. And yet, the world leaders, the people who are making decisions for the nations and voting at the UN, have no difficulty supporting resolutions that say that the division of Jerusalem should be according to the green line, which means every component of the old city goes towards the Palestinian capital. It's amazing. When I present this, and people have opportunities to question me everywhere I go, in including environments which are much less hospitable than the one tonight. I was invited to Columbia University. They have lots of guests, but very few of them who come to support the positions of the Jewish people. On my way over with my wife in a taxi stuck in traffic in New York, the young lady that was supposed to guide us kept talking about what would happen to us once we started to do the presentation at Columbia. She said, you know, have you been interrupted? Have you been attacked? Have you been, you know, and I, after a while, I said, could you please be quiet? I just want to prepare for this. You know, there are so many hostile environments, and yet the truth must be spoken. But in those places, which is fascinating, when I point out the fact that dividing Jerusalem on the basis of the Green Line means all of the Old City will be in the hands of the Palestinians, people don't know. So much ignorance and lack of knowledge, which is lethal in this moment. Next. The actual analysis of which leads me to my legal conclusions begins with the Herzl's thesis. What's important here, if you want to go to the next slide, is the title. Herzl was not the first to present the thesis that the solution to the Jewish problem was a Jewish state. By the way, the Jewish problem. This is not a problem of the Jews. Problem of the nations. It's our problem. The problem of the Jews is a problem because for centuries and centuries and centuries they were persecuted, they were kicked out of countries, they were burnt at the stake, they were mistreated by not one but a multiplicity of nations. And Herzl, who was an intellectual, not a person of particularly strong faith, but understood justice and injustice. At one point, having witnessed the trial of Dreyfus in France, said, I thought that if we were really, really good citizens and we completely assimilated and were exemplary people, people would stop mistreating us. And then he saw Dreyfus, and he saw the anti-Semitism that was so rampant in France then. I have to be careful, because I represent the government of France even now. He said, it won't work. We've got to come up with something else. And he came up with his thesis. Now, interestingly, he was not the first one to propose this kind of a Zionist solution. Others, in fact, in my view, were far more articulate in presenting the solution. I think of Moses Hess. If you haven't heard of him, he wrote in Rome and Jerusalem in 1862, what we have to do at present for the generation of the Jewish nation is first to keep alive the hope of a political rebirth of our people, and next to reawaken hope when it slumbers, and when the political conditions in the Orient shape themselves as to permit the organization of a beginning of the restoration of a Jewish state. But what is left of our nation is mighty enough to rebuild the gates of Jerusalem. This is our mission. In Auto-Emancipation, Pinsker presented again the answer, this thesis that it had to be a Jewish state. He believed that there was a real link between the return to the land and the spiritual renaissance and restoration of his people. He wrote wonderful things. I recommend Auto-Emancipation by Pinsker. But what Herzl did that none of the others did, and I think that's why he's so admired, is what he did in 1897, 1 year after the thesis was published. In Basel, Switzerland, he organized a conference, brought together only 198 Jews from around the world. Can you imagine? Only 198. But he did something which was considered impossible. He united the Jewish people. You know, there's an old saying that if you put 12 Jews in one room, there'll be 12 different positions on whatever issue you present to them. He unified them and launched the movement that led to the creation of the State of Israel many decades later. What's important here is the title of his thesis, The Jewish State. When people challenge me and question me about what the Zionist movement was all about, isn't it obvious? It was a Jewish state, not a little community in Palestine in those days. They wanted the state. Next. The turning point, the next turning point, is the Balfour Declaration. And only a few seconds on this subject. The Balfour Declaration was a key moment in history for the Jewish Zionist movement. Why? Because it was Great Britain in 1917, a great empire, a mighty superpower, that says, we will help you establish a Jewish national home in Palestine. They make a pledge. They make a commitment. However, contrary to what I've read here, there, and everywhere, it's not the Balfour Declaration which is a source of the rights and obligations that are relevant today. It was the pledge of one nation that did even control Jerusalem or most of the Holy Land in 1917. They were still fighting the Turks. And they certainly did not have the legal power of disposition. And yet, this declaration helped the movement. So, we know what was not the source. So the question is, what is the source? If the rights have been given, when and where? We continue. That's Balfour. He wrote to Rothschild, the president of the Zionist Federation. Next slide. Now, here's where it happened. If my friend was here, the guitar would go again. Pay attention to this. The Paris Peace Conference. This is where the Zionists on one side and the Arabs presented their claim. Imagine this. A courtroom. Judges. And you have a document in your hand, which in Canada we would call a statement of claim. So when you start a lawsuit here and you prepare the document that you present to the judge, it's got a name. It sets out your position legally, but your claim is not the source of rights and obligations. It only becomes a source of rights and obligations if the judicial group, the judges, decide to recognize your position. Does that make sense? I'm telling you that the claims were presented in Paris. Let's keep going. The Arabs, in fact, it was not all of the Arabs. It was one powerful grouping, tribe of Arabs, the Hashemites, represented by Faisal, present their claim in Paris at the Quai d'Orsay on February 6, 1919. And what you see there is representatives of five nations. This is a key cornerstone of my argument. The judges were those five nations. The principal allied powers. The great powers that were the main victorious nations in the First World War. Five of them. Very important to remember that. Next. The Arabs ask for one large independent state to be recognized where the Ottoman territories were. Next. At the start of the Paris Peace Conference, Weizmann, and even before the start in 1918, Weizmann and Faisal meet in order to discuss how they can support each other's claims. And they in fact sign an agreement just before the peace conference in which Faisal promises to help the Jews with our national aspirations. Next. The conference takes place at the Quai d'Orsay. Paris, 1919, here's the Quai d'Orsay. For 6 months, the Allies are listening to different claims with regard to the German territories, with regard to reparations, with regard to disarmament, but mainly territorial claims to punish the defeated nations. Next. That's my picture of the Quai d'Orsay now. It's still there. On the Seine is right in front of it. It hasn't changed much. But that's where, when I said that there was a big room, a big courtroom, that's where it takes place. Next. Five nations composed the Supreme Council, but there were really four men. A very key person, leader, was President Wilson, Lloyd George, Orlando, and Clemenceau. Next. What the Jewish delegation is asking for during this very crucial moment is they don't want a Jewish state right away. They want a nation to be appointed, to be a custodian, to be a guardian, to be a trustee, because there are only about 70,000 Jews in Palestine at that time, whereas there were 700,000 Arabs. So the whole game plan for the Jews is protect us, come in, and allow us to immigrate. The 14 million Jews around the world would be given the right to immigrate so that we can constitute a majority, and then we'll have a state. We'll declare independence. That was the game plan. Let's see. Next slide. The Jewish presentation, and it took forever to find some of these documents. I've never seen the minutes of these meetings. I found the minutes. So if you want to know anything that was said, all the questions that were asked, I found them. February 27. Here are the five nations. Here's the Zionist mission led by Weizmann. There's Sokolov, Levy, Yuzhiskin, and the five nations. Remember what I told you. Five nations who together have the power of disposition. This is the key to everything. They will get title from the defeated enemies and can turn around and give title to somebody else. What England didn't have at the time of the Balfour Declaration, these five nations will have. Next. Weizmann plays a very, very key role. If someone deserves the title of architect of modern Israel, I think he does. Ben-Gurion played a very key role. Herzl, of course, played a very key role. But when you follow what Weizmann did over the decades, it's extraordinary. Next. Here's what they ask for, more specifically. In a few words, stay with me here. They ask for recognition that the Jewish people are a people in law. They ask for recognition of the historical connection between the Jews and the land of Palestine. Okay? This is very important because there are many people around the world today who can go to someone and say, we used to be over there. We want our land back, including in this nation. If you're going to give title to a people just because they used to be there 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, there would be chaos in this world. They're asking the five nations to recognize their historical connection. But then they ask for something else. Wow. Would you believe that they dared to ask for the recognition of the right to reconstitute what they used to have? Think of Jerusalem. I think the Jews had a lot of stuff going on in Jerusalem over hundreds of years, over thousands of years. And they're asking the five nations to recognize their right to reconstitute, to rebuild what they used to have. Can you imagine a bold or the delegation to ask for such a thing? What happened? They asked for a territory. Next. The territory is configured in a very interesting way. There's land on the west side of the Jordan River. There's land on the east side of the Jordan River. Next slide. And for those of you who are very familiar with the distribution of land to the 12 tribes, just about every inch of land that was relevant biblically is covered by the map proposed to the powers, to the five powers. Next. So what happens? Wilson played a very, very key role. Now, this is such a tragic story in a way, because the real dreamer, the one who had a very large heart, an enormous spirit to support the creation of an organization to protect the world, to promote world peace, was Wilson. And we're talking about the League of Nations. That was his baby. He participated in all the sessions in Paris where they were discussing the final terms of the what was called the Covenant of the League of Nations. Next. The Covenant of the League of Nations. Nothing like this had ever been done before. Nations would be linked together, part of an organization to promote world peace and to prevent the horrible things that led to the worst war in the history of mankind, the First World War. Then, next. It was in Geneva that they set up the headquarters of the League of Nations. That's the building that's still there today. Next. They put together the terms of the covenant of the League, and this is one of the cornerstones of my arguments again. Article 22 is the one that says that in certain areas, taken away from Germany, from the Turks, instead of simply handing over the prize to the victorious nations, which is the way it was done for centuries and centuries and centuries, you know? I believe you had a little fight with your neighbors here, and in the end, you ended up with sovereignty over an area called Texas. That was done. It was appropriate. But Wilson wanted to change that. He didn't want more wars, so he said, we'll do it differently. We'll set up a system, and he refers to it as a sacred trust of civilization. A sacred trust. This is part of the covenant. Covenant. That's an interesting word when you're Jewish or Christian. The covenant of the League. And Article 22 says that they will set up trustees or mandatories so that the inhabitants or certain people will benefit from the protection until they can have independence. Next. You can't read this from many parts of the room, so many treaties were done, and the key thing in the treaty is that the five nations I've referred to receive the rights. You know, whether we're talking about Romania or Bulgaria, you will see in the key articles that title to the territories go to the five nations. Next. In this Treaty of Versailles, you see Germany renounces in favor of the principal allied and associated powers, the five. All rights and title over our possessions. Why is that important? As a lawyer, it's very important. Because if I'm going to buy a house from you, I'm going to do a search. I'm going to make sure that you own the house before I give you my check. If you don't have title, you cannot convey the property to me or title to me. So here's the principle. The five had the power of disposition, the right to give title. Next. Here's another treaty, same thing happens. Same five nations get it. Next. This is a map of Europe, showing you how many chunks of territories in Europe were conveyed from the losing nation to the allies that won the war, proving the power of disposition of the five. Next. We get to the Ottoman territories. They've lost, and they're going to have to pay for it. The leaders in Paris have been so busy dealing with the German issues and many other issues that they leave the conference in mid-1919, having made no decision concerning what was presented by the Arabs and the Jews. Listen to what happens. They reconvene in the Italian city of San Remo. Next. They have a conference with only the five powers and some military leaders and some assistants to deliberate. Think of a courtroom, think of the judges, they've heard the presentations, they go into their chamber, they go into their office, and they sit together and say, what are we going to do? Are we going to say yes? Are we going to recognize? Are we going to reject? They do that for 2 days, April 24, April 25, 1920. We're really, really required to pay attention here. This is crucial. They're deliberating on whether to say yes to the Jews and yes to the Arabs. What next? They meet in the Villa de Vachon. When I realized the importance of this villa and realized that no one almost ever mentioned it in any of the hundreds of books and articles that I'd read over 20 years, I said, I've got to find this place. Next. This is a newspaper that some really precious friend found, dated May 2, 1920, just a few days after the conference, with a beautiful lithograph of the villa. Next. This is the room in the villa where the decisions were made. Next. Look at this. I discover the importance and significance of this villa. We get in a car with my wife and one of our daughters. We drive over there. I find out that it's now a luxury condo, and I'm able to rent an apartment for a few days in the villa. When I get there, and people find out about the work that I've been doing, I'm invited by a very kind older lady. She was German. She was in her 80s. She was so fascinated that I was paying attention to the villa. She was one of the owners, that she said, come and have tea. I gladly accepted the invitation. Listen to what happens. As we're having tea, she says, I'd like you to have this. She gives me a big brown envelope filled with pictures of the leaders never seen by the world before. The world doesn't want to know about this conference. The nations are very uncomfortable. Was it Mr. Gore who came up with the title of Inconvenient Truths? These truths are also inconvenient. Next. These are the leaders in front of the villa. Why is it so important? Next. They, on April 25, having deliberated, make a decision. They, with the power of disposition over the Ottoman territories, make the decision to adopt the policies set out in the Balfour Declaration and give to Britain a mandate over Palestine for the purpose of establishing a Jewish national home there. At the same time, they say yes to the Arabs and decide to give them large territories that were formerly under the control of the Turks. And we'll see those in a moment. Fantastic day for the Arabs, because they say yes to most of what they've asked for. So when I'm attacked about the relevance of St. Remo, when there's a claim that my foundations for the Jewish rights is weak, I say, be careful. It's also the foundation for all the rights given to the Arabs. You can't tell me that these five leaders had the power of disposition for 10 minutes in the afternoon and the next 5 minutes they lost it when they dealt with the issue of the claims of the Jewish people. Next. Here they are again. I have several pictures because I want you to believe that this conference took place. Next. The military leaders were there as well. Next. By the way, San Remo, if you've not been there, is a very nice place. It's the Italian Riviera. You take the car, turn right, drive a little bit, you're in Monaco. It's a neat place. It used to be really sought after by tourism, by the tourists, and many decades ago. But that's where the villa is located, on top of the hill. Next. Today, it's been upgraded. It used to be a villa. Now they call it the Castillo. Next. That's my picture of the villa today. And you see the door that's open there? Some of you might see it. Some of you might not. But that's where we were. And it turned out that we were in the exact room where the meetings took place. We could tell from the columns on the wall. Can you imagine a guy who's been doing research for years? I have the minutes of the meeting and I'm sitting on the veranda smelling the roses and looking at the sea not too far away, and I'm reliving what took place there in April of 1920. You know, it's hard work when you do this, but there are moments that are impossible to describe. Next. You know, I speak to a lot of Jewish gatherings. Just two weeks ago, I spoke four times in the Knesset. I was invited by the Department of Justice to speak to a gathering of lawyers. That morning, I read the Jerusalem Post, and there was an interview with the Minister of Justice, Ms. Livni. And she responded to one question saying, "No one can teach us anything about Jerusalem." That afternoon, I was in the Ministry of Justice speaking to a bunch of lawyers there. And it's an awkward thing. Because I was saying, you know, I'm not Israeli. I'm not from Jerusalem. I'm not Jewish. And here am I. I want to tell you about what I've discovered concerning the rights of the Jewish people to Jerusalem. They gave me 1 hour and kept me for 3 hours. It was a special moment to be followed by an invitation to meet the most senior lawyer in the Department of Foreign Affairs of Israel. See, here's the problem. The Jewish people, I've been told so often that they're outlaws, so often by the nations that they have to get out of that land, that regrettably I've discovered that many have started to believe that they are usurpers and wrongdoers. And my mission, my mandate, my goal is to look at them and say, listen, the legal considerations don't answer the whole problem. Politics is relevant. It's not just about law. But if you're going to sit down at a negotiation table, don't walk into that room with your tail between your legs thinking that you're a thief in any part of Jerusalem. You're there as of right. And for a while, there were many who, I guess, didn't believe what I was saying. They were kind to me. They had to be impressed by the fact that I worked on this for a while. But deep down, they didn't believe it. And what I've started to notice, it is one of the most amazing things for me, is how many now are saying, okay, come back and talk to us some more. And after I left Jerusalem a few weeks ago, I keep getting emails. Can you explain that aspect? We didn't quite get that. Tell us again. I get emails every day. Because it's hard sometimes, because I go and speak to leaders around the world, to many parliaments, and they listen to me and they say, oh, that was interesting, but why doesn't the government of Israel say what you say? So that's part of my challenge. Next. Oh, back up. You know, in those Jewish communities and in these Jewish settings, you can't help but feel that sometimes people think that I'm overstating, I'm exaggerating the importance of St. Remo. Here's what Wiseman said. The St. Remo decision has come. That recognition of our rights in Palestine is embodied in a treaty with Turkey and has become part of international law. This is the most momentous political event in the whole history of our movement, the Zionist movement, and perhaps no exaggeration to say, in the whole history of our people since the exile. This is what Wiseman thought of the decision in San Remo. And I go around the world and I ask Jews and non-Jews, do you know how important San Remo was? So what happened after? Next. There was a treaty put together in which all the key terms that were decided upon in San Remo are incorporated. Article 95 of the Treaty of Sèvres. And you will see that 4 out of 5 powers are in the treaty. The U.S. is not there, because the U.S. never declared war against Turkey in the First World War. So they were not part of this peace treaty. Next. As a result of San Remo, 3 legal instruments, 3 international treaties are prepared. One for Lebanon and Syria, and that one stipulates in the key provision that that territory is going to be under mandate for the benefit of the inhabitants. Clearly, it's stipulated. Next. Iraq, Mesopotamia. A treaty comes out of San Remo. It's all already decided in San Remo. But the treaty codifies what was decided and says that territory is for the inhabitants of that land, under mandate, in this case, of the British. Syria and Lebanon was under French mandate. Next. The mandate for Palestine is the treaty prepared to codify the rights given to the Jewish people. In Article 2, it is clearly stated that the purpose of the mandate is the establishment of a Jewish national home, as laid down in the preamble. And as a lawyer, please note the importance of this, because all of a sudden, what's in the preamble is important because it's incorporated in the key disposition clause. Please, you've got to hear this. This is so important. The article that gives the right brings in the preamble. Rights are also given to the inhabitants. Their civil rights, their religious rights must be respected. So I'm not here to say that others, the Arabs who lived there then or now, have no rights. They have rights. But the political sovereignty rights are given to the Jews. Which Jews? Not the Jews, just those living in Palestine at the time, the $70,000-$80,000, but the 14 million Jews worldwide. The mandate is for the Jews worldwide, who are considered virtual inhabitants of Palestine. Unique concept legally. Next. What's in the preamble? You can't see most of it, but what it says at the bottom, the key provisions, is that the historical connection between the Jews and Palestine is recognized. That's what they asked for in Paris. They got it. You know what else it says? And the grounds for reconstituting what they used to have. They got that too. The ramifications of this are so great. When the Balfour Declaration was being drafted, they tried to put in the terms to reconstitute, and it was rejected by the war cabinet, saying, they'll have too many rights. Well, I don't care that it's not in the Balfour Declaration. It's in the treaty. Next. I put all 3 next to each other, and it's clear that in 2 treaties, political rights, sovereignty rights, are being held for the benefit of the inhabitants. In the mandate for Palestine, it's for the Jewish people. Next. In the mandate for Palestine, it was prepared a certain way and then amended. This is really important in terms of justice. All of a sudden, the British, who were having political problems with the French, who, after St. Remo, go into Syria and kick out Faisal and bring in the army, and all of a sudden there's a crisis with the Arabs, and the British are trying to find a solution, And they have the mandate amended to include Article 25. Article 25 says that in the territories lying between the Jordan and the eastern boundary of Palestine, this is so important. We're talking about Transjordan. All of Transjordan was Palestine. So when the Arabs were given Transjordan, they were given Palestine. The Arabs have a country in Palestine. In all the documents I read, it's referred to as East Palestine. It was more than two-thirds of the area promised to the Jews. So you see what it says here? That even though the British can do what they did and give that to somebody else, it's subject to complying with Articles 15, 16, and 18 of the mandate. Next. Article 15... certain rights, no discrimination on the basis of race, religion, and language was to be permitted. That's in the part that was taken away in Transjordan. You know what the Hashemites did? They kicked out all the Jews. They prevented any kind of religious practice. No schools, nothing. In contravention of this. Next. Article 16, it's another provision that had to be honored, which was not honored in Transjordan, in East Palestine. Now, let me apply this to the disputed territories today, to the occupied territories. What the world is saying to the Jews is, we want a Palestinian state there, according to the Green Line, and we don't want any Jews left. We don't. They want to do in the new Palestinian state what happened in Gaza, what happened in Jordan. There's a standard for the Arabs. There's a standard for the Jews. As far as the Jews are concerned, they must make sure that all the rights of the Arabs living in Israel are respected. 100%. If one is not respected, they go to the Supreme Court of Israel, and the Supreme Court of Israel agrees with them. As far as the future Palestinian state is concerned, the game plan is for all the Jews to leave. What kind of world are we living in where the nations consider this normal, consider this just? This is a gross injustice. Do you understand what I'm saying? They've introduced conventions at the UN to prevent discrimination on the basis of race and religion, which have been embraced by the nations. They apply to all except for the Jews, because the nations are very comfortable with the concept of telling every Jew to get out of East Jerusalem. Even the president of this nation is making declarations to the effect that Jews should no longer build any apartments, dwellings, homes in East Jerusalem. He's joined the chorus. And that's deplorable. It's not good for the United States. Next. I'll skip that next. I'll skip that one too. Now, I want to show you something. I've worked on this for now way more than 20 years. Can you believe that having concluded that the mandate for Palestine is the Magna Carta, it's the Charter of Rights and Freedom for the Jewish people, the foundation, together with San Remo, for their rights. Can you believe that I could not find anywhere in the world a copy of the original? We did a lot of research in Geneva to try to find a copy of this crucial document, which is still relevant today, and I'll tell you why. Went to London. The British were the mandatories. You'd think you'd find a copy of the mandate for Palestine in the Central Archives of London. Yes? The lady, another older lady, embraced our cause and looked for us. She was the head archivist in London. couldn't find it. It took months and months, and we sort of gave up. A wonderful, wonderful friend from Switzerland was sort of leading the efforts in this regard. And then one day, he received a package from her. In the package was a disc, and on the disc were pictures of the mandate for Palestine and other mandates. It took her 8 months, 10 months. She was obsessed with the fact that she couldn't find it. And here's what's on the picture. This is an old leather red book, and there's a label on it. Okay, next picture. You can see what it says. She found it. It says League of Nations, British Mandates in East Africa, Togoland, Cameroon, and Palestine. Somebody tucked the mandate for Palestine and an Africa file next to Togoland, Cameroon, and East Africa. She was baffled. Who could have done such a thing? Was it deliberate? So you can imagine, I'm looking at this document, and if you Google Mandate for Palestine, you'll find hundreds and hundreds of copies everywhere. They're attached to books, articles. It's easy to find. Try to find a signed copy. I searched for years and years and years. Never found a copy that was executed. So, can you imagine next? As I'm looking, here's the Mandate for Palestine, French and English. I've got both. Next. This is a front page. Next. Next. Keep going. Just keep going. Next. 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 Stop here. My heart was beating. I would finally find out who signed this extremely important document, which I presented to different members of parliament in the Knesset a few days ago. Next, here's the signature at the bottom of that page. It is signed by William Rappard. He was then the Director General of the Mandate Section of the League of Nations. And instead of having this signed by the Secretary General of the League of Nations, it's signed by the head of the Mandate Section, William Rappard. Next, here he is. Who's William Rappard? He's born in the United States of Swiss family, ended up educated at Harvard, brilliant man, went back to Geneva, and was instrumental in setting up the League of Nations and having Geneva chosen as the seat of the League of Nations. Next. What is that? Do you remember that pink mention I showed you where I defended my thesis? He was the founder of the institute where I defended my thesis. That's a picture of the same house in 1927. Imagine how interesting, captivating for me to discover that. To have defended my thesis in an institute where almost everybody is supportive of the Palestinian cause. I did feel like the Lone Ranger occasionally. And to find that this man not only had signed the mandate for Palestine, do you see how many things have happened along the way between the Villa de Vachon and this and finding the minutes of the meetings? What a captivating, amazing journey this has been. And I have no doubt, no doubt, that the reasons behind my success and the open doors today are because what I'm doing is important to the Holy One of Israel. I have a big responsibility on my shoulders because I'm not Jewish. In fact, I'm a Christian. In fact, I was able to sing along with the guy with the black hat. But it's often necessary to be very discreet about my faith, because I want to be heard as a scholar. I want to be heard as a jurist. Remember what I said to you at the outset tonight. When you come and present arguments and you base it on faith, considered myths by many, or scriptures, considered irrelevant by even more, it's not helpful. You know, there's an expression, you know, sometimes you can be so spiritually minded that you're no earthly good. Have you heard that one? My mission, my work, is to bring to the attention of the nations the extent to which what they're doing is disregarding the rights already granted. In British law, we call it res judicata. In French law, chose jugée. Decisions have already been made. The rights have been given to the Jewish people as far as Palestine is concerned. Next. This is a map which shows that Syria, everything changed there as of April 25, 1920, shows the importance of San Remo. Next. Here's what happened. That's all the green was what the Arabs got in St. Remo and then in the treaties. And the blue, all of Palestine, east and west of the Jordan, was supposed to be for the Jews. Next. But what happened in 1921 when Churchill took away from the Jews to placate the Arabs because of what the French had done, two-thirds of Palestine is taken away. First partition. Next. And now the Jews are trying to fight to retain a segment of West Palestine, despite the fact that all the decisions have been made in respect to the entirety of East and West Palestine. Next. In the Treaty of Lausanne, 1923, the Turks give up all their rights. So this was occupied territory until 1923. Next. The League of Nations, of course, collapses and is dissolved, stops really meeting during the war. And the final resolution is in 1946, but it's clear in the final resolution that the UN is supposed to take over and to administer those territories for the well-being and development of the peoples concerned. So what the UN is supposed to do now is to take care of the rights of the Jewish people in that land. Next. Article 80 of the UN Charter specifies that all the rights given to any people before the entering into of the UN Charter have to be protected and preserved. Next. The partition resolution. In 1947, you know that the UN passed a resolution, and can you imagine, 1947, come on, let's be fair. They're telling the Jews, well, you're supposed to get way more, but we'll vote to give you a little chunk. The Jews are just traumatized. This is just after the Holocaust. Many of them are still in camps. Can you imagine if I come to you and negotiate something after you've just had a car crash? You're sitting there dazed, bleeding and hurting. And I say, here, would you like to sign this? And yet that's what the nations did. The Jews being entitled to all of Palestine on both sides of the Jordan River are now being told, we'll partition Palestine. Do you accept? And you know what they said? He said, okay. The Arabs said no. But the Jews said yes. Because they had no choice. Because the refugees were piling up everywhere and the devastation of the Holocaust was so palpable, so evident. Partition resolution of the General Assembly was not binding. General Assembly resolutions are not binding in international law. It's a recommendation. If Jews and Arabs had accepted it, put it in a treaty of peace, it would have been a source of rights and obligations. But it was rejected. Next. By the way, Jerusalem wasn't supposed to be part of the Jewish state, wasn't supposed to be part of the Arab state. It was supposed to be a corpus separatum. It included Bethlehem as well. And there was going to be a referendum in 10 years. And everybody I read, Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, they all said, that's okay, we have a majority in Jerusalem now, we'll wait 10 years, and once the doors are open, we'll have such a majority, we'll win the referendum, and we'll add Jerusalem to the Jewish state. That's why they accepted this proposal relating to Jerusalem. Next. That shows you the partition plan with Jerusalem and Bethlehem in the center. That was supposed to be the international regime. Next. Again, the UN partition plan. Next. We're almost done. The special regime. Next. It shows you the area that was supposed to be separated, the corpus separatum. Yes. And I'll finish with this for my conclusion. People say, well, the mandate for Palestine? That's old stuff. How can you rely on this treaty that was done so many years ago and take the position today that the Jews have rights to Jerusalem or rights to the disputed territories? Well, the International Court of Justice, when I wasn't thinking about the Jewish people, in respect to Southwest Africa, remember, Southwest Africa was an area that was under mandate with South Africa as the mandatory. And after the League disappeared, South Africa said, we'll take it. We'll become sovereign over the mandated territory. And then the nation said, wait a minute. And the International Court of Justice got involved and said that even though the League is gone, the mandates are still applicable and relevant. When they're talking about Southwest Africa, they say it's still relevant. Next slide. Again, the court is saying that the raison d'être and original object remain. The mandates are still relevant until a final determination is made respecting to the territories. Next. Again, the court says that the territories that were under mandate under the League must continue to be protected for the benefit under the sacred trust of those people who are named as beneficiaries in the mandated territories. Resolution 242 of the Security Council doesn't change any of my conclusions. It says that Israel has agreed to depart from territories if the states around it are prepared to really make peace. None of the conditions have been made, and there was no commitment to come out of Jerusalem. My conclusion. Again, it doesn't matter what the majority says. They're wrong. There's a spirit of hostile prejudice which is motivating the governments of the world today, and increasingly the Jewish people individually in different nations. The proposition that Jerusalem or part of Jerusalem should be free of Jews, Juden-free, is an outrage. It's unconscionable. It breaches all the fundamental principles of justice. The issue of Jerusalem involves the rule of law, the rule of international law. And the nations are contravening the legal rights of the Jewish people and of the state of Israel. Recognition has already been given to the historical connection of the Jewish people to Palestine and to for them to reconstitute what they used to have. And that means the old city cannot be taken away from the Jews. In fact, no part of Jerusalem can be taken away from the Jewish people. I think we're living in very, very precarious times. When injustice can be so disregarded, when what is, in my view, so unrighteous can be considered so righteous, the nations of the world have to be very careful. Because ultimately, the truth will prevail, and what is right will be recognized. Thank you. I would like to do two things. I'm going to take a few questions if some have questions. But before, I would like to take a copy of the original mandate for Palestine with a signature and everything and offer it to a man who's been such a precious friend of the people of Israel, the Jewish people, Dr. Lehi. I would like